going to see a very strong second half of the year, probably 20% economic growth.
Not everyone agrees with the White House economic advisor. This is Tuesday, May 12th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also coming your way, some are expressing worry at the White House over the coronavirus. China reports another rise in COVID-19 cases. And we'll take you to Hong Kong, where scuffles broke out late last week at its Legislative Council. It's all coming your way on today's VOA Asia. In April, the U.S. unemployment rate grew to an unprecedented 14.7%, according to a new report released by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. That's the highest unemployment rate and largest single-month change since 1948, when the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics started tracking the numbers. While White House experts are hopeful the economy will quickly rebound, others are not so optimistic. More from VOA's Elizabeth Lee.
The new coronavirus is not only a danger to health, it is also devastating to the U.S. economy. The number of jobs lost in the U.S. hit 20.5 million in April. It's not going to get better in the near future, says White House National Economic Council Director Larry Kudlow.
I think the numbers for May are going to be also very difficult numbers. It's going to take a while for the reopening to have an impact.
Kudlow says even with devastating job losses, he sees a glimmer of hope because a number of the unemployed are due to furloughs and temporary layoffs.
That, by the way, doesn't assure that you'll go back to a job, but it suggests strongly that the cord between the worker and the business is still intact.
The U.S. stock market has seen gains even at a time of soaring unemployment rates. Analyst Lizanne Saunders says among the reasons, one of them is the government stimulus.
And two, I think, is on the assumption that the market is looking through sort of the valley and that maybe April will be the worst month, the inflection point. I think there's some risks associated with that. You've got the potential second wave of the virus.
Even with the continued health risks, there have been protests to end the stay-at-home mandates. Many states are gradually reopening, and Kudlow says the signs point to the U.S. economy ending the year on a positive note.
We're going to see a very strong second half of the year, probably 20% economic growth. Next year, 2021, could be a tremendous snapback in the U.S. economy.
But that may be too optimistic, cautions Neil Kashkari, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis.
This is more likely to be a slow, more gradual recovery. Unfortunately, the virus continues to spread. People continue to get it. Unfortunately, people are tragically dying. And when we look around the world, there's evidence that when countries relax their economic controls, the virus tends to flare back up again. If this goes on for a long period of time, I think it's going to go on in some phases for a year or two. I think Congress is going to need to continue to give assistance to workers who've lost their jobs.
So far, the government has provided close to $3 trillion in financial assistance during the COVID-19 crisis. Democrat lawmakers are pushing for another stimulus package, including aid to state and local governments, plus money for testing and the unemployed. Kudlow says there have been informal discussions, but many Republicans are taking a more cautious approach to another stimulus package.
Many people would like to just pause for a moment and take a look at the economic impact of this massive assistance program.
As businesses reopen, people will have to balance work with the potential risk of getting sick from the coronavirus. Many economists say how quickly the economy rebounds may depend on when a vaccine becomes available. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
We invite you to read more about our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now at voanews.com. South Korea is extending school closures by an additional week as new COVID-19 infections are on the rise. At least six members of the Afghan National Army were killed and five others wounded in a Taliban attack in Langmin Province in eastern Afghanistan Sunday night. A report published on an Indian newspaper website says Indian and Chinese soldiers exchanged blows Saturday at North Sakkim along India and China's border. And China is expected to ignore a Philippine protest over the upgrade of a disputed island in the South China Sea. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and at the voanews.com website. We continue now on VOA Asia. COVID-19 has reached the White House. Reporter Sagar Magani has the story.
A Trump advisor is worried with the coronavirus making its way into the White House complex. Two people who work there are now known to have tested positive for the virus, one of the president's valets and Vice President Pence's press secretary. While the president says he's not worried about the virus spreading, economic advisor Kevin Hassett says it's scary to go to work at the White House. On CBS's Face the Nation, Hassett called the West Wing a small, crowded place. It's, you know, a little bit risky. But Hassett says there's also frequent testing and an excellent medical team. The White House has moved to boost protocols, with the president saying some people who interact closely with him will now be tested daily. Pence says he and the president themselves will now get tests each day, too. Sagar Magani, Washington.
China reported another rise in coronavirus cases Monday as the government reminded people to step up personal protection against the virus. The warning from Mi Feng, a spokesperson for the National Health Commission, came as 17 new cases were reported, up from 14 the day before, which had represented the first double-digit increase in 10 days. Of the 17 new cases, 7 were listed as imported, while 5 were in the city of Wuhan, the epicenter of the pandemic, where a strict lockdown was lifted last month. Another 5 cases were spread across 3 northeastern provinces, including Jilin, where authorities suspended train services in and out of a country where a cluster was recently detected. China has recorded a total of 4,633 deaths from the virus. Happening now in Asia, China warned Monday that it will take countermeasures in response to a U.S. decision to tighten visa terms for Chinese journalists and urged the United States to immediately correct what it called its mistake. The U.S. last week issued a new rule limiting visas for Chinese reporters to a 90-day period. Make sure you stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are very happy you're with us on VOA Asia. A Maine coronavirus vaccine trial, a joint venture between an American and a German company, got underway this week in the United States. Some participants are U.S. medical students. This trial joins others around the world as pharmaceutical companies compete to discover the breakthrough for COVID-19. VOA's Carolyn Prasuti takes us through what's being done and how.
Michael Sikorsky is about to make history.
Look in that corner.
He is the 7th medical student to get an injection of a trial vaccine for COVID-19.
I feel a sense of responsibility and obligation as a young, healthy adult who can participate in one of these early trials to do so.
Sikorsky and 360 others are in the first phase of vaccine trials run by Pfizer and its German partner, BioNTech.
And you can do all of this from the outside.
The company is simultaneously testing 4 vaccines using a newer method called mRNA. The vaccine introduces part of the virus's genetic code through RNA. The body treats it like a foreign protein, which generates an immune response. Pfizer's Mikhail Dolstein.
And now the body is ready. It has memory. And once the real virus knocks on the door to infect us, we respond fast and intercept it.
The challenge for Pfizer is to prolong the life of the antibodies in the cells. Many drug companies are racing to become the first to conquer the virus. U.S. firm Moderna, along with the National Institutes of Health, is using mRNA in trials that began last month. Inovio has already started its efforts using a DNA method. BioNTech Pfizer began its trials May 5th, while China's CanSino Biologics is ahead of the others, already on to its phase 2 trials. The University of Oxford in England started trials last month, and Wuhan and Beijing researchers are using a traditional trial method, injecting inactive viruses. The nation's leading infectious disease expert predicts the world will have an effective vaccine by October.
And then the challenge will be to scale it up enough to be able to distribute it meaningfully.
Meanwhile, participants like Sikorsky are monitored for vaccine safety.
So every night at 9 o'clock, I get a little buzz on my cell phone that reminds me, fill out your safety diary. So I take out the thermometer that they gave me and I check my temperature. And then I fill out a series of questions, which include, do you have any aches or pains? Do you have fevers? Is there swelling?
If all goes well, a coronavirus vaccine is expected to be in circulation by the end of the year. An unprecedented rapid development for a vaccine. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. A new report says Chinese direct investment in the United States dropped to the lowest level since 2009 last year amid bilateral tensions, and the COVID-19 pandemic will continue to weigh on investment flows between the world's two largest economies. All of the big stories come your way throughout the day at VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue now. Scuffles broke out at Hong Kong's Legislative Council on Friday as lawmakers from opposing camps competed to preside over a meeting held to determine who has authority over a key committee which scrutinizes bills. VOA's Steve Miller got in touch with reporter Rhea Mogul in Hong Kong to talk about it.
Hundreds of protesters gathered in malls to chant slogans and sing songs, which is actually quite a common form of protesting in Hong Kong. The protesters had initially planned to march down a major road in Hong Kong to demand the resignation of our chief executive, Carrie Lam. But there was no permit, obviously, because of social distancing rules. And so they gathered in malls instead. And then the police entered the malls and took people away because they were gathered in groups of more than eight. And as the current social distancing rules stand, you're only allowed to be gathered within a group of eight people. But many people believe, actually, that the government is using social distancing to suppress the protest movement. And in scenes quite reminiscent to last year's anti-government movement, protesters attempted to block the roads by using bins and traffic cones, and pepper spray was fired in retaliation. Several pro-democracy lawmakers were also present, and one lawmaker was arrested as well. Now, the police have also faced accusations of brutality yet again and have particularly come under fire for suppressing journalists. They forced them to kneel and stop filming what was happening around them. Also under fire, the police are under fire for taking away a young 13-year-old boy who was part of a youth reporting group, and he was filming what was happening around him, and they took him away. So people were very angry about that, very angry about the multiple rounds of pepper spray fired on the streets as well as inside the malls, and of course, not allowing the press to film what was happening around them.
You mentioned the police taking away a young boy. This is not the first time that has happened. It's also not been the first time that there have been allegations that the police have restricted what journalists can film or report in these things. Has there been any response from organizations, say like the Hong Kong Journalists Association, about what took place?
Yeah, the union and also the FCC, the Foreign Correspondents Club in Hong Kong, have publicly condemned the police for stopping journalists from allowing to do their job. And, you know, they think it's particularly bad that they were made to sit down, forcibly kneel on the road and stop filming what was happening around them. Also, as you said, yes, it's not the first time that the police have taken away a young boy. In fact, you know, majority of the anti-government protesters are young people. You know, they're in university or they're in high school. So it's very common. And the police have responded by saying that they used the appropriate level of force. Next month, we'll be coming up to the one-year mark of that historic 2 million strong march in Hong Kong. So I imagine during these big anniversaries, there's going to be some sort of protest or demonstration.
VOA Steve Miller speaking with Hong Kong reporter Ria Mogul.
How dangerous is COVID-19? 80% of the cases are said to be mild. Young and healthy people are at a relatively low risk. Elderly and people with serious health conditions are at risk of fatality. If you have a cough, fever, and shortness of breath, contact a doctor and stay away from other people. For more information, visit the websites at the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease and Control. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
Personal protective equipment is a term many people have become familiar with since the COVID-19 outbreak a few months ago. There's a big demand for them around the globe to help protect against the virus. However, factories that make the protective gear have not been able to keep up with demand. Dave Grunebaum shows us how volunteers in Malaysia are answering the call.
Before meeting with patients, Dr. Katrina Kadir sanitizes and suits up in personal protective equipment, or PPE, to avoid catching coronavirus.
So every patient that comes through the doors is considered as positive. So until proof otherwise, so we need to make sure that we are fully prepared and protected when treating the patients.
The plastic face shield she's wearing is not from a factory. It was made in this home about 10 kilometers away. It's where William Elvis has turned his dining room into a production hub, with 8 3D printers making face shields. Elvis is part of a Facebook group with more than 500 volunteers producing PPE for frontliners across Malaysia. So far, his family has spent the equivalent of about $1,500 of their own money to make thousands of face shields for hospitals across the country.
No other people are more important than the frontliners. And if they need something, then I gotta produce it. That's my thinking.
Before this global health crisis started, Elvis already had one 3D printer. Friends recently pitched in to buy another 4 so he could produce more face shields. The other 3 printers belong to a community center Elvis co-founded but is currently closed. Elvis, a salesman at an e-learning company, has not worked much recently. So he spends his time producing PPE.
I got into this because I like to do a lot of tinkering and I love community. So these are two elements of bringing the tinkering and the community together into this field.
Elvis got designs for the face shields from the Facebook group. The process starts with spooled plastic filament. It's fed into a 3D printer where it heats up, melts, and is layered onto a heated plate and then shaped. Each machine produces 2 frames at a time in about an hour. Elvis's wife Miranda adds a plastic sheet to the frames, which provides the actual protection.
My motivation is this. I got to protect the front line at all costs, because if they go down, who's going to protect me? Who's going to protect us? And these are the things that they need it right now. They cannot wait for anything. So we have to step in and do our part.
I would like to say a big thank you to all these volunteers who have come up with a lot of donations and efforts in making sure that the frontliners are always well protected.
So the appreciation flows both ways, as volunteers help protect frontliners, so the frontliners can protect the public. For VOA News, Dave Grunebaum, Kuala Lumpur.
People are working to make connections with each other despite coronavirus quarantines keeping us apart. Neighbors delivering groceries, professional athletes bringing medicines, and the world's very best musicians serenading entire neighborhoods. VOA's Arash Arabasadi brings us this good news from New England, where a teenager's nonprofit connects loved ones to patients in quarantine hospital rooms.
These signs point to a COVID-19 screening site in Boston, where staff received donated cell phones that may change lives of patients in isolation.
There's a ban on visitation in the hospitals right now, and patients, you know, don't have the abilities to connect with their loved ones, so that's kind of where we step in.
19-year-old Kaya Sooner co-founded the nonprofit COVID Connectors. Both of his parents work as emergency room physicians, and the idea came during an online chat with his mother, who mentioned lonely patients in isolation, many of whom are elderly.
I just posted on Facebook and said, hey, if anybody has any devices, let me know, and I can work with my parents to get them into hospitals. And the response was pretty overwhelming just on Facebook alone.
Sooner says they collected 650 devices for Rhode Island hospitals in a week. COVID connectors then expanded into other medical centers throughout New England and plans to expand into New York.
The patients in the hospitals who have used them are super grateful, and then the families who have been able to connect with their loved ones are grateful.
COVID connectors' work earned public praise from Rhode Island's governor, further boosting its profile and helping secure more than 500 devices from Amazon. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Movie theaters have shut their doors to the public due to COVID-19. To offset lost revenues, some have teamed with distribution companies and created online platforms where viewers can watch new releases virtually. VOA's Penelope Pulo spoke with a distributor and a theater manager about the new viewing model.
It has been lights out for U.S. movie theaters since the onset of COVID-19. Hollywood studios have postponed big budget releases such as Disney's Mulan and the latest James Bond installment, No Time to Die. Independent productions and smaller movie theaters are the hardest hit because of narrower profit margins. Dire circumstances spawned virtual cinema, a digital movie platform. Michael Rosenberg spearheaded the streaming service.
The idea here is twofold. One is to get our films in front of the public and continue the so-called theatrical release in partnership with theaters and allow the theaters to have some source of revenue while they're closed.
Virtual cinema is user-friendly at the website of distribution company filmmovement.com. At a click of a button, viewers can pick new releases and buy an electronic ticket. The price is the same as at the box office. Theater owners and distributors split the revenues 50-50.
These films are not available on Netflix or Hulu for the most part. They're not buying foreign language art house films. They're not buying classic art house films.
Such as the Icelandic thriller, A White, White Day, and other acclaimed independent movies.
Corpus Christi, which was one of the five films nominated for the Oscar for Best International Cinema Picture.
Or remastered film classics like Luchino Visconti's L'Innocente. But the significance of the virtual cinema goes beyond eclectic film viewing. It is about keeping the community together and independent movie theaters afloat during these tough times, says Jean de St. Aubin, who heads the Jean Cisco Film Center in Chicago.
The biggest thing about going to a movie in a public place is being with other people, it's talking about the film. And so we've been hosting virtual conversations with filmmakers. And because of this technology, we've had filmmakers in Massachusetts, Ireland, actors in LA. So it really kind of opens it up.
She expects some moviegoers will keep viewing virtual cinema even after theaters reopen at a reduced capacity. Yet,
there's gonna be people who are gonna be standing in line before the doors open, because they're going to be so hungry to be with other people and to be in a big theater.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can like us on Facebook at VOA Asia, follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia, and you can find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao, our VOA Asia team, including Keith Lane, Doug Bernard, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.